This archival recording is part of a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist. TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Face of Imperialism, Michael Parenti. Dr. Michael Parenti has written about empire history, the media, theology, and socialism in his decades as an activist and teacher. However, one topic has intrigued him more than others. He wrote that imperialism has been the most powerful force in world history over the last five centuries, carving up whole continents, oppressing indigenous peoples, and obliterating entire civilizations. Yet it is seldom accorded any serious attention by our academics, media, and political leaders. End quote. Parenti addressed that omission in his most recent book, The Face of Imperialism. He spoke at a benefit for radio station KZFR in Chico, California. He was introduced by Doug Everett, host of Radio Parallax, followed by General Manager Rick Anderson. Here is Doug.
Michael Parenti is a social commentator about whom the New York Times Book Review said, "Mr. Parenti offers a valuable rebuttal to the drumbeat from the right," and I certainly agree with that, and I'm sure you will too after you've heard him. I first heard him give a talk about the military industry at a conference in Washington, D.C., and I turned to the guy next to me and said, "Who is this guy?" And I later learned who he was. He's authored 23 books. He's been an award-winning political scientist, historian, cultural critic, and lecturer. I think it's fair to note that I don't always agree with Michael's take on issues, but I always find his ideas worthy of consideration. And more than once, he's forced me to change my opinions, and I'll wager that some of you may experience that tonight.
Thanks, Doug. Please welcome Michael Parenti.
Thank you. Well, all the funny and clever people tonight, I'm going to be serious. I'm going to be very deadly. What I want to do is remind us that we should not be afraid of words. And I noticed them being used in these Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Chico, where people are using words that are really filthy, prohibitive, verboten words that you are not allowed to use, words like capitalism, words like imperialism, words like the super rich. This marvelous formula that's been put out, which says it so well, 1% you guys, 99% us. And you've got these Republicans getting up and saying, look at them doing their class warfare on us. And, of course, they've been doing class warfare on us every day, every minute. Do it. The audacity is amazing, the way they not only expropriate our land and our labor and our money and our wages and our taxes, they also expropriate our words. Do you know back in the early 19th century, the word manufacturer meant the worker? Manus factum, right? I make with my hands. Mano in Italian, meh in French. All French words are eh. So they've expropriated the word, and that word is now taken over by the owners. The owners are called the manufacturers. They don't manufacture anything. They just accumulate. Well, I want to talk to you about empire and imperialism, because there's a lot of mistaken notions about it. What is the U.S. global empire? What is it? Well, if you read Chalmers Johnson, and he's written three books on empire, and he knows very little about the subject, I have to say. I'm not usually that catty and competitive, I know. But he said, our empire is an empire made up of military bases. And there are, and there's no denying, there's about 700, 800 military bases. In Japan alone, there's something like 40 bases, military bases, U.S. military bases, in Japan alone. It's not just bases, though. It's also a global network of military and security forces, paramilitary forces, and police in countries across the world. All of these guys, potential killers of anybody who gets out of line. All of them financed, equipped, trained, and advised by the U.S. Pentagon, the CIA, and related agencies. In Africa, for instance, in Africa, there are 50 nations that have military, extensive military aid from the U.S. 50 nations. Now, there's only 53 nations in Africa. So a lot of these wars that they hype up and trump up to shatter the populations and shatter the communal production that goes on, a lot of these wars are fought between two sides, both of whom have been armed and trained by the United States. But now empires are not just motivated by power for power's sake. Power is an instrument of empire, not the end all. The goal of empire is to expropriate the wealth of the world. The subsidiary goal is to make the world safe for the expropriators, to make sure any rebellious counter-organizing movement, leader, or nation comes along, that nation will be hit. The goal is to prevent political leaders and movements and nations from charting an alternative and potentially or actually challenging political economic course. The goal may also be to eliminate competitors who may not be all that radical, but who attempt to strike a self-developing path, a self-determining course. This process of expropriation and domination is called imperialism. Imperialism is what empires do. Imperialism is the process whereby the dominant interests in one country expropriate the land, the labor, the natural resources, the capital, and the markets of another country. The plutocrats do to other countries what they also seek to do to their own. That's always my answer when somebody says, you mean we're going in there and we're forcing those countries to cut back on their human services and we're buying up their lands and we're doing this? Why would they be so interested and dedicated to doing that? Why are you so paranoid? Why do you have a conspiracy theory? Why are you cynical? Why would you think they'd be doing that? And I say, well, they're doing that to us. These plutocrats and these global leaders are doing that very thing. They want to get rid of Social Security. They want to get rid of Medicare. They want to get rid of all the human services that we do have. They want to give it all over to the private market. They want to cut back wages. They want unemployment. They don't mind recession. Recessions are not bad things for moneyed interests. These are bad times, but not for everyone, not for the 1%. It's a jobless recovery. Their profits are higher than ever. Recessions are always pretty good. Recessions allow the big companies to buy up small companies at garage sale prices. Recessions allow big capital to squeeze out and outperform small capital with even greater ease than usual. Recessions tame and even break labor unions. Recessions even tame labor itself. Forget being in a union, just people working, being able to get a job behind a counter, a job they never imagined that this was the one I was going to have after college, but actually feeling grateful that I got this because it's one inch away from starvation. So we have today in America massive hardship and record profits. It's not bad times for everyone. In 1989, I gave a talk in Berkeley, and I said that the goal of the Bush administration, this was the old man, Bush Sr. was in power then, the goal of the Bush administration was the third worldization of America, and that still is the goal. And that happens to be the goal for every nation, the third worldization of everywhere. In the United States, the rollback began really in earnest in 1978. It was the beginning of the third year of Jimmy Carter's administration. And I remember reading a quote from a business council individual. The business council had decided it's time to wage a counteroffensive. And he said, if we don't stop these so-called advancements, we will end up a social democracy. Now, that term leaped off the page to me, because there's only about 600 people in all of America who know what the term social democracy means, and maybe about 200 of them are sitting right in this room, I guess. A social democracy means a country that is capitalist, but it's very heavily restricted capitalist and heavily regulated, and it's got some socialized components to it, like socialized medicine, heavily subsidized housing, and all sorts of social programs. The social wage is a very substantial one, as in Norway, Finland, to some degree in France, and Sweden, and you know what I'm talking about. But the term leaped from my page because it was some guy in the business council. I never knew they talked about social democracies or used the concept. It was showing an ideological class consciousness that the American plutocracy very rarely wishes to reveal. You see, when they say there's class warfare, they're the victims of it. You're committing it against them. But they would never talk about their class warfare. But here he was using the term. And Jimmy Carter did move. When the business council blew the whistle on him, the last 2 years of his administration, he cut back on human services and he increased the military budget. And some of us, after Reagan was elected, looking back, said Reaganism began 2 years before Reagan came in. The trouble with Carter is no matter what he did to try to please the plutocracy, he was still beholden to labor unions. He was still beholden to the black vote, to low-income vote, to the liberal intellectuals and so forth. And so they really wanted a guy who could go all the way and really hit. And so they went with Ronnie Boy, Ronald Reagan, to bring America back to what it had been through most of its history, a mass population of people in straitened and scarce means and circumstances living from hand to mouth, 1929. Their dream is really to get us back to 1900, where there'd be no more environmental protections, no more regulations, no more controls, quality controls on commodities, consumer protections. There'll be no child labor laws. If kids want to work, why shouldn't they exercise their free enterprise and do it? They don't want a population that is well educated, a population that has a keen sense of its own entitlement, a population that is critical and discerning. That isn't what they want. Their goal is to get theirs. And that's it. Don't believe me. Believe the cover of this week's New Yorker magazine. Have you seen it yet? Cartoons have the greatest truths. They speak truths with a few strokes. It's a picture of the New York Stock Exchange, and in front of it are all these money bag, those big mustaches and the striped pants and the top hats, and they're carrying signs, and the sign is saying, "This is precisely the way we want things to be." And another one's got a sign saying, "Change, schmange." And another one is saying, "I've got mine, and long live the 1%, or something. And so there they are. They're not stupid. And that's the same with foreign policy. Foreign policy, it always comes up. Why is U.S. policy so stupid? It's not stupid. It does exactly what it wants. It operates with amazing consistency and with amazing success. It has stopped social democratic and reformist and revolutionary and democratic movements in almost every country throughout the world, in Honduras, in Chile, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Venezuela, in pre-Chavez, and you can go all across Africa and all across Asia. Any country that has tried to reform and better itself has come and gotten the full force and fury of American power. It has a smashing success, and yet we get books like Chalmers Johnson's book and others like that who write and say, U.S. policy, and here's some of the quotes. I've got a bunch of them in my book, The Face of Imperialism. This is, U.S. policy is inept, reckless, misguided, overreaching, arrogant, deluded, aggrandizing, and so forth. I think U.S. policy is very rational and consistent. The U.S. empire builders support those dictators or democratically elected governments or tribal governments or ethnic groups that follow the New World Order of free market capitalism.
You are listening to a 2011 speech on the face of imperialism by Michael Parenti. This is a tribute to his work.
The U.S. imperialists oppose those dictators or democratic governments that seek an alternative to free market capitalism, that seek economic self-development, communal development, and the like. Gaddafi's real sins, you think they really cared that he killed some people? They hyped up the numbers and exaggerated the numbers, but you think they really suddenly got a compassion? There are dictators killing people all over the world now, and suddenly it was so urgent to stop him. But his real sin is that he wouldn't allow the International Monetary Fund in. He kicked the oil companies out. He took the earnings from the oil and he built housing, medical care, and educational systems in Libya. And he built those magnificent aquifers. He brought them up from southern Libya into the north so that people could have clean drinking water and good clean water for farming. All of that is going to ruin now. Milosevic, the same. He was democratically elected, but he was called in the media a dictator and the like. And supposedly all the killings in that war in Yugoslavia were perpetrated by the Serbs only. Most of the killings were not perpetrated by the Serbs. I wrote a book on that if you ever want to look at it called To Kill a Nation. Noriega in Panama, Chavez in Venezuela. He has won 5 out of 6 national elections. Aristide, who won 3 elections and has been kicked out of office 3 times. Allende, who won Democratic elections. It doesn't matter if they're Democrats or if they're not Democrats. And this has been the thing with all of these guys, with the Noriegas, with the Milosevic, with Gaddafi. You demonize the leader, and this gives you license to bomb their people and destroy their country. The central consideration is a political economic consideration. It's not about power and for power's sake. It's not about overreaching and aggrandizing. It's about whether or not this or that group abides by the IMF, by international finance capitalism, abides by the oil companies and the trade cartels? Or are they pursuing policies for the many rather than the few, communitarian, socialistic, and the like? How do these empire builders get the American people to go along with this? By using fear and convincing them that they are beset by enemies and political demons from abroad, and by demonizing this or that leader without ever giving you any details. How many times has Gaddafi been called mad, mad dictator, this or that? How many times has Mubarak been called mad, mad dictator? Never, never. Mubarak of Egypt, 30 years he's been in office. 30 years he's been coming down on dissidents. And he was always referred to in the U.S. media as President Mubarak. He's even now called ex-President Mubarak. Not a word about him, because he does let the IMF in. He does let American capital in. He does sell his country down the road whenever he can or needs to. And so we are rallied. We are told to rally around. And the American people are very reluctant to get into these wars. The initial polls almost always show they do not want to go off and bomb people in Somalia. They don't want to bomb people in Iran and in Iraq. And they don't want to bomb people in... I mean, how many wars are going on right now that two-gun Obama is fighting right now? At least 6 is near where there's some fighting. You remember the war against communism? For decades, it was the war against communism, the ruthless, relentless communists who won't ever stop. Well, the communists just seemed to have unraveled and disappeared. Then it became a war on drugs. And then there was finally, and now, thank God, they were searching. There was a period there in the mid-90s. They were frantically searching for enemies. And it was the war on terrorism. And that's what it became. There are, of course, those of us who argue or ask, are you fighting terrorists today or are you creating them when you go bombing countries and blowing villages to pieces, countries that are not even remotely linked to al-Qaeda? Do you have any evidence that al-Qaeda really is a organized global network with a command center and all that? Is there really any evidence for that? The imperialists cannot tell the American public, we want you to die for the free market. We want you to die to make the world safe for the super rich. No, so what they say is that all these involvements are compiled by humanitarian considerations. We fight only humanitarian wars. And we get all sorts of liberal and even progressive people getting up, as they did with Yugoslavia, as they did with Libya, and forget everything they ever learned and stand shoulder to shoulder with the Pentagon and the CIA and the White House and the media. The very same people who say, don't trust what the media say to you, they listened and they swallowed it. Or we have to fight a war to ward off an aggressor, or defend our national security, or free a country from a tyrant, or fight terrorism. For decades, it was said that we need to be everywhere with our guns and missiles, our ships, our helicopters. That was for the Soviet Union. Why do we need this enormous military budget? Because we're facing a Soviet empire. When the Soviet empire evaporated, that military budget did not shrink. That military budget increased. In fact, it's been growing at a faster rate since the early 1990s than before. So it's not the Soviets. It's to get in everywhere and make the world safe for those who own the world. If anything, the U.S. leaders have become more unbridled, more violent. They invaded Panama. They invaded Haiti twice. They invaded Somalia. They destroyed Yugoslavia. They invaded Afghanistan. They invaded and occupied Iraq and destroyed it. They just, this last 6 months, destroyed Libya with 2,000 sorties. And they were probably going to create another militant Islamic extremist militant base there. The empire sees only two types of states beyond its borders. Either you're a vassal state, a satellite, that is, or sometimes called a client state, and you do what we want. You throw your land labor markets open and say, come on in, boys, it's all yours. Invest whatever way you want and all that. That's the vassal states, and the allies are pretty much qualify as vassals. I mean, they pretty much stay within the NATO perimeter. In fact, they play a major role in some of the operations. And the second kind of state is an enemy state or a potential enemy state. If you're not a vassal to the global imperialists, then you are a potential enemy. If you are committing independent acts, we have to keep an eye on you. And since you're a small state, we don't say Iraq is a danger to us. We say Iraq may emerge as a regional power. And that region is the Middle East. And that was what they were saying. They're now saying that same terminology in regard to Iran, which they're getting ready to hit. Because they learned the formula from Libya and from Yugoslavia, which is you can destroy a country without losing a single soldier. You just hit them from the air. Destroy their utilities, their ports, their power lines, their houses, their hospitals, everything else, their transportation systems and the like. And so the crucial determinant is, where does a nation fit in its economy in relation to the global economy? The empire also feeds off the republic. Where do you think the empire gets its resources to do all this? They get it from us. They get it from their own people, from our taxes. The empire is a very costly affair. Rich global military power. The Pentagon is stronger than ever, but a poor, depleted republic. Indebted states and municipalities. The empire is not in decline. There are a whole bunch of books that have come out about Sorrows of Empire, Twilight of Empire, and the like. The empire is not in decline. It's stronger than ever. The republic is in decline. There's whole-scale resistance. Occupy Wall Street, occupy Chico, occupy Oakland, and the like. Now, ultimately, the empire, like any parasite, may kill its host. It's made devour the republic, and that's, in fact, what I seem to be describing. I mean, we have a republic whose public services are going from bad to worse, whose fiscal viability is going from bad to worse, major breakdowns of state and local governments, budget crises, the same story. Everywhere I go, I look in the local papers, every single state government in debt, can't meet this, cutting back on programs, spending freeze. Well, what do we do about this? Here's what I think we should do. We should move toward socialism. And here's what I mean by socialism. Don't be frightened by it. The sub-theme of this talk was do not be afraid of words. They teach us to be afraid of words like imperialism, capitalism, socialism. You want to know what socialism is? I remember teaching my students at State University, and they say, socialism, how would it be? What would it be? How would it work? I said, well, you're sitting in it right now. You're going to a state university. Nobody's making a profit off this. It is publicly funded, and you're getting an education that's every bit as good as some of the private universities that are just down the road, and even better than most of the private universities. So don't say socialism doesn't work. It's working for you. You're using it. And the French medical system is socialist, and they're all happy with it. And you don't have people ready to die because they can't get medical care. So I say, socialism, use it when it works. I support socialism because it works and when it works. Other times when it doesn't work, maybe you can try communal ownership or private ownership. Cuba is going into private ownership for certain kinds of services and such, because to have the state be the plumber, go to the state to get a plumber, you wait 5 days, and by then you may be drowning. But in healthcare, education, utilities, transportation, environmental care, in banking, we have one state in the union, North Dakota. North Dakota, the only state with maybe two others that is not facing a crisis of insolvency. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the monies that North Dakota collects from the people go into public banks. And they don't go off to private banks that siphon off and make money off it. We had a bill that was passed this legislature, is that not right? And that Jerry Brown, who pretends to be governor of this state, vetoed it. He said, no, we leave our money in private banks. You really have lost it over the years, Jerry. Okay, the thing is that you shouldn't lose it. And whether you agree with everything I said or not, even my dear beloved friend Doug had to say that, I don't agree with everything he says. Oh, but you learn, you get your eyes opened and you get a little, gives you something to think about. If I did that, thank you very much.
That was the acclaimed author, activist, and teacher, Dr. Michael Parenti, speaking on imperialism. He appeared, along with comedian Will Durst, at a benefit for a California radio station on October 27, 2011. KZFR in Chico is volunteer-run, community-based, and listener-supported. Tune in to 90.1 FM next time you drive on I-5 between Sacramento and Red Bluff. Thanks to Kyle Porter of Paradise Audio for this recording. Michael Parenti grew up in a conservative, Catholic, working-class Italian community in New York City. He's a prolific author and an engaging speaker. He wrote 23 books, among them Democracy for the Few, Super Patriotism, History as Mystery, and Against Empire. His website is michaelparenti.org. A link is on TUC Radio's website. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information on how to order a one-hour audio CD of Michael Parenti's Face of Imperialism, recorded in Berkeley and Chico, California, by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.